Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has been rendering some impressive service in that war, particularly in his latter years. He was a master of the universe on Wall Street initially, but he has become a very important figure in the conservative movement and a clarion voice on a whole host of issues through his terrific television podcast program, The Bill Walton Show. He is, of course, Bill Walton, and he is a regular here of ours at Secure Freedom Radio, of which I am very proud. And we're going to start with him on a couple of issues, Bill, that are really perhaps not so much surprising as shocking. Let's start with the COP26 summit meeting, as it was called, a few months back in Scotland. And what we've learned about some of the shenanigans that have flowed.
Frank, it's great talking with you. The COP summit happened actually less than 90 days ago, November in Glasgow, and it was an assembling of all the luminaries from the global finance industry, among other groups. And they came together with a project they're calling United Nations Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero. That's quite a mouthful. And what they did, the big banks and financial institutions around the world, including the Federal Reserve and the Treasury, had a role in this, and they committed something like $130 trillion over the next decade or two to cut greenhouse gas emissions and carbon emissions. And it's an interesting
$130 trillion. Is there that much money in the universe, Bill? I mean, yes, over 10 years, it's less, of course, per year, but still, that's a staggering sum. Sounds unlikely to be fulfilled. What do you think?
The odds of finding $130 trillion are only somewhat greater than, or lesser than, cutting carbon emissions to net zero by 2050. Go back to the, 16th century and gather our heating and from cutting down trees and forests, but that's a topic for another day. It's $130 trillion. They think that they can do that by investing in carbon-free technologies and companies, and they want to direct their investment capital to that end. And they, you know, they're very, very bold. They don't think governments, interestingly, have enough money or have enough purpose to do what they can do. And Larry Fink, and who runs BlackRock, and Brian Moynihan, who runs Bank of America, are just out there saying, well, look, the governments can't do it, so the private sector's got to come together and make this happen. It's sad how, to me, how pervasive this has become. You got Joe Amato, who runs Neuberger Berman, which is not a small company. They run about $500 billion in assets themselves, and they think that they can redirect their investment portfolio to bring this about. And they think by taking these trillions and investing them in new technologies and new companies, they will bring about the change they want. These are smart guys. These are guys that can really do a good job managing money. And yet when it comes to this green initiative, they seem to have checked their analytical skills at the door.
Well, there may be another explanation for it, Bill, and I wanted to talk to you about that. There was corruption is the term that I was looking for, actually. Talk to us about this article that appeared in the Wall Street Journal just the other day, in which we were informed that, as they put it, Wall Street's green push exposes new conflicts of interest. What's up with that, and how serious a problem do you think this is?
Well, this is a wonderfully interesting topic. The thing to remember about the financial services industry is it's not just the banks and the commercial banks and the investment banks. There's a whole host of players, auditing firms, bond rating agencies, companies that advise on proxy voting and other kinds of things that put a seal of approval on companies or on bonds or on equities. And it's almost comical. Everybody talks about ESG investing, but nobody really knows what it is. And nobody really knows what sort of seal of approval companies should get to be clarified, to be classified as an approved green investor. And they begin splitting. And so you've got all these people rushing into this business, and it has the same conflict of interest that the bond rating agencies have always had, which is they're paid by the issuer to rate the bonds. And we saw how well that turned out in 2007, 2008, where the rating agencies had an incentive to rate the companies more highly than they actually were. And in fact,
as I recall, a little company called Enron in particular, right?
Well, AAA rated, Frank, up until it wasn't. I may exaggerate, but we got a very high rating. Then the bubble bursts and everything collapses, and the rating agencies will say, well, look, we were just doing doing what we were told and worked the information given to us by the companies, and pointing the fingers in all the other directions. Well, always following orders. Well, it didn't really change the business models, even though there are a lot of problems with it. And so they're still getting paid by issuers to rate the bonds. And now they're seeking to get paid by companies to have them rated as green investors. And it's funny how they begin to split the differences. They're rating even companies in the oil and gas industries as green. There's one company that's in the business, and it's in the oil and gas business. But they've decided it's a green business because it only owns the properties, but it actually isn't doing the drilling for the oil, and so therefore, because it's just a property owner, it's a green company. As I said, there's an awful lot of I think cynicism in this, because you know Wall Street understands there's a very popular investment product. There's a lot of people now who want to be thinking they're green investors investing in environmental, social, and good governance policies and companies that promote that. And so investors want to buy it, and the financial services firms and all the rating agencies and what have you are willing to provide it.
A little self-dealing along the way, and a lot of smoke and mirrors, it sounds like. And this reminds us of something that apparently is afflicting the Chinese communists, or at least their population as well, Bill. Talk a little bit about the property bubble in China and how green is now featuring into some of those shenanigans as well.
Well, the Chinese are nothing if not alert and opportunistic. And the Chinese eyed this ESG mania, and the big property developers in China got into the business of selling ESG green bonds. And this is another one of these categories that, if you're not paying attention, sneaks up on you. You know, 5 years ago, there weren't green bonds. Now, because of the perceived investor appetite, they're slapping green on real estate bond offerings. And that worked pretty well until the property collapse in China and the problems with Evergrande. And now investors have bought these bonds. Are now seeing them traded about 30 cents on a dollar. And it's not a small business. Chinese property companies issued almost $10 billion of green bonds in 2021, which is up from just $2.5 billion the year before. And, you know, one company, this junk-rated Yazoo, sold $562 million of green bonds last year, and they only had to pay little over 6%, which is outrageously low for a junk bond. And these bonds now, they're bid at 21 cents on the dollar. So
is there reason to believe that American investors have been snookered in this same space as well?
Well, we're selling green bonds in the capital markets all over the world. And, you know, this gets back to the conversation you and I've had over the last 6 months. Investors have got to do their due diligence. And because your broker says, gee, this is a developing country, China's going to grow, you got to put some money in China, or they say to you, gee, this company is a green company and you want to promote cleaner environments, so therefore this is an attractive security to own, you really got to look under the radar and you really got to do your own work before you jump into something like that. So yeah, it's happening. It hasn't happened as extremely here because we haven't seen something similar to the property collapse that we've seen in China in the last 12 months. But it can happen in any market sector.
Well, I'm actually thinking of U.S. investors in those Chinese green bonds, not just whether we're going to see a similar kind of pattern of, self-dealing and corruption.
Well, U.S. investors are included in the group that are getting these huge haircuts.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter whether you're Chinese or you're U.S. You there's no we don't get special privileges. In fact, there was an issue with the Evergrande workout where they had a bondholders committee, and the Chinese initially excluded all non-Chinese actors from the negotiations, and they wanted to negotiations just between the local provinces where the bonds were underwritten, and Evergrande and the Chinese bondholders, and a couple of the big investors outside of China got together with a tough New York firm, and I think have fought their way into the negotiating room. But Chinese instincts were not to let them in,
and it remains to be seen now that they're in how well they're going to fare inside.
Not well,
Bill. Yeah. And to your larger point, this is a problem of Western, specifically Wall Street capitalists, making substantial sums through commissions and fees and other arrangements with the Chinese. But their clients may not fare so well. And this is particularly why we believe our Committee on the Present Danger China, of which I'm proud to say a member, and its Mad as Hell campaign is so important. We need Americans to wake up, as you say, to the reality that their financial managers' interests may not be the same as their own, especially when it comes down to aiding and abetting the threat from China. Which brings me, Bill, to another topic that I want to just touch on.
Just one point I wanted to make. It's an old saw from the 1920s. There was a book that came out, and it was titled, "Where Are the Customers' Yachts?" The brokers owned all the yachts and the customers owned barrels.
Yeah, our friend Steve Bannon makes that point with some regularity, and so right. And if you're expecting a yacht and you don't have one yet, you might want to go to your financial manager and say, get me out of China. And there are a lot of good reasons for doing that. And we're going to have more information about how you can do it at our Committee on the Present Danger China website, presentdangerchina.org. Bill, let me just ask you about another piece of the problem with China and what we're doing in underwriting it, which of course is the practical effect of those investments. It's money into the Chinese Communist Party, and it is used by them for whatever purposes they see fit. And some of it has to do with espionage. The Department of Justice has, I believe, starting in the Trump administration and continuing, to my surprise, somewhat in this administration, had a so-called China Initiative, where they were trying to run down at least those in academic circles in this country who have been involved in what's known as the Thousand Talents Program. Talk to us a little bit about that and what's going on with this China Initiative at the moment, and whether the problem is bigger than just these academics and academic institutions.
Well, it is bigger. We've talked about the fact that the Chinese have been really integrating themselves, insinuating themselves into every institution in America, whether it's a business or a research lab in a university or on the campus and universities via the Confucius Institutes. And we have some instances where the Chinese have paid off American scientists. There's one scientist at, I think, MIT that was paying $50,000 a month to turn his research over to the Chinese Communist Party. And so there's anecdotal and statistical evidence that this is an ongoing push by China. And China's been very good at trying to turn the tables on this, and they're taking kind of the thing we're dealing with now, which is pushing back against critical race theory, and they're simply saying now this espionage your attempt to capture China or Americans working on behalf of the Chinese Communist Party is racist. And so therefore, we shouldn't be enforcing our laws and protecting our own interests here. And it's working in part. I think it didn't work with Trump, but under the Biden administration and their effort to be seen woke, it'll be interesting to see if they continue the Justice Department crackdown on espionage, and whether our Attorney General there will continue the initiative that Trump has taken. I fear not.
I fear not as well. And the point is that there's a concerted effort to make him decline to continue to work on this. This whole idea that it's racist and so on feeds into many of the administration's worst instincts. Bill, we're following that closely, and I know you will keep doing so. Let me ask you just one last quick question, if I can. Chinese company Huawei has been a serious problem in this, this country to some extent, but really around the world for some time. And to the extent that it has inveigled its way into the Belt and Road Initiative, most especially, but into an awful lot of our allied nations, that problem is becoming more acute, it seems, really by the day. And I wondered what your thoughts were on this this company, where it stands, and whether we are right to be, pressing for its exclusion, certainly in our own country, but elsewhere as well, and if the Biden team is up to that.
The issues with Huawei are real, and they are engaged in technology transfer, and transfer that helps the Chinese military and intelligence gathering strategies. And so the sanctions we put on are working, and they're working in such a way that Huawei's business, it was once the world's largest telecom equipment maker, and yet it's seen its sales drop pretty significantly in the last year or two. But the Chinese being the Chinese and knowing how Washington works, they recently, within the last year, have hired Tony Podesta, who's the brother of Clinton's White House Chief of Staff, John Podesta, and they're paying him, they paid him over $1 million in the last half year lobbying the Biden White House. And so it's business as usual in Washington, and unfortunately, the Podesta brothers don't see any problem in working with the Chinese to restore a mortal enemy or a company that's engaged in part of that activity back to they want to rehabilitate it.
And again, that activity is espionage. It is data harvesting. It is penetrating, this society as well as others where it's been able to get.
He's not alone. They've spent over $3.5 million in 2021, which is really which is about roughly eight times which they spent in 2020. And so they're not. They're not sitting back.
They're not taking it lying down, as they say.
Yeah. But the question you have to ask is: you're sitting in you don't do it so much with the lockdowns and the vaccine passports. But if you're sitting in a Washington restaurant, looking around at the lobbyists, you have to ask yourself: how many of these lobbyists in this restaurant are on the Huawei payroll?
Huawei, yeah. Well, or otherwise working for the Chinese Communist Party. That's a pregnant question to which we will return with you next week, Bill. Thank you so much for joining us, Bill Walton. Check out The Bill Walton Show, folks. Must-see TV, for sure. We appreciate your time. Thank you. We'll talk with you again Monday next week. God bless. Next up, we will speak with Karen Sigeman about the loss of a great American, who he was, why it matters, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to a dear friend and very valued colleague. Her name is Dr. Karen Sigeman. She runs these days a terrific organization based out in the Left Coast, out in Southern California specifically, called the American Freedom Association. She is a highly sophisticated, intelligent, knowledgeable, articulate champion of freedom, perfectly suited for this role of leading, behind enemy lines is the way I think of it most days. The effort to espouse the values and the constitutional freedoms of our country, particularly to people who are not much into those sorts of things, it seems, out there on the, as I say, left coast. She has, unfortunately, had the duty of calling to my attention and a lot of other people the passing of another friend and valued colleague who worked with her closely at the American Freedom Association, as with all of us in a number of other capacities. And to memorialize the great Larry Greenfield, I wanted to have Karen on to note that America's freedom-loving community is notably smaller these days. I'd have to say also that we lost this past weekend another great champion of freedom, Jack Singlob, and I might ask you a little bit about that too. But Karen, first, thank you for joining us here at Secure Freedom Radio, and I'm so sorry for this loss, and anxious to hear your thoughts on where we are as a result of losing Larry Greenfield.
Well, thank you so much, Frank, and what a lovely introduction of me, and I so appreciate that. And honoring and memorializing, as you say, such an amazing proponent of freedom, yes, of free speech, of freedoms generally. Larry Greenfield was a wonderful and dear friend and ally. I had first met him, I was heading over to Berlin in 2010 to an anniversary of my father's school, and somebody said, oh my goodness, my dear friend Larry Greenfield will be also in Berlin at the same time. What are the odds? He was heading a school trip throughout Eastern Europe, so that children could see those parts of the world that had lived under totalitarianism and tyranny. And this was through the Reagan Legacy Foundation. And so that was my first encounter with Larry, was when he was actually actively doing a project, undertaking action to ensure that children be inoculated against totalitarianism by this trip. So we met then, and I was so impressed with his eloquence and passion and how he was such a learned man and such an eager teacher. I don't know that he had done much with students after that time, but he was always teaching us, always. He had podcasts. He wrote voluminously, most notably in the Jewish Journal. He was an active fellow for the Claremont Institute. He had headed up a regional chapter of the Republican Jewish Coalition. So it wasn't just freedom generally. He was very, very motivated, driven to do all that he could to celebrate and maintain everything to do with Israel. He was actively fighting for Jewish voices, for Israeli freedom, fighting against anti-Semitism. Just such a wonderful and erudite champion. If there were an idea that floated through his mind, he would do a deep, deep, deep research dive into it. I was just reading, he wrote an amazing 6-part piece on freedom of speech, and it was historic and everything magnificent. He was such an advocate.
You know, Karen, let me just say, I saw him most recently, as I did you, but for one encounter that we'll talk about here in a moment, at the David Horowitz Freedom Center's Restoration Weekend in Palm Beach in November. And he was kind of the deputy master of ceremonies. He presided over a number of the programs of that event, which is always one of the best in the country, second perhaps only to yours. He was so full of life and so clear about the challenges that not just this country, and not just Israel for that matter, but the free world more generally is confronting. And he just reminded me, he gave me a very generous introduction in a speech that I was privileged to make, but he just reminded me, as he always did, of the kind of irrepressible happy warrior that, you know, the times really require. The rest of us are often a little dour about the challenges that we're facing. Larry was somehow always able to find a way to capture the positive and the opportunities amidst the challenges. And I'm so sorry we're going to be lacking his presence, but I know we'll be guided for the foreseeable future, at least I hope, by his spirit. Let me ask you about the thing that brought us together most recently as well. And I should just say, before we leave the subject of great Americans, I did want to just say a further word about this other great hero of our country who passed this weekend. His name was General John Singlaub, known universally as Jack. I don't know if you ever had an opportunity to interact with him, Karen Sigeman, but I did. We gave him an award, actually, probably 20 years ago now, at the Center for Security Policy. He lived to the ripe old age of 100, and up right to the end, he was still going incredibly strong. And sadly, as will happen to all of us in due course, it just the body wore out. But I think the thing about Jack that I would also just note, as with Larry, was that completely indomitable commitment to freedom and anti-communism and anti-tyranny more generally. And Jack, in his particular area of expertise and specialization, was literally a warrior. Our friend Larry was a freedom fighter in the war of ideas, I like to say, but Jack was one of the most accomplished and courageous and brilliant special operators in the United States Army, and served with great distinction in a whole series of capacities deep behind enemy lines often, and with the intelligence community. He was one of the Office of Strategic Services veterans, which was the precursor, of course, to the CIA. And just an amazing man, and he will be much missed as well. But let me talk about the freedom fight we're in at the moment, because it brought us together at the march in Washington last week to defeat vaccine mandates. You flew in from California for the purpose, and we had some time to visit, which I will cherish always. Tell us a little bit about the event and what brought you across the country for it and what you took away from it.
Yeah. And you're right that our ranks are diminishing, and it is painful. And yes, I did fly out for the Defeat the Mandate rally. We had been watching these around the world, huge numbers in London and Berlin and Paris and Australia even. And you know, where are our people? We're America. We should be out there like crazy. Of course, we're geographically more spread out and so on. But when there came time for a national event such as there was last weekend, there was no way on earth I was going to miss it. This is the existential threat of our time, not the vaccines per se necessarily, but they as part of a terror vehicle for putting us under various forms of control. The event was defeat the mandates, not the vaccine, although, you know, the vaccines have issues of their own, but it's the mandates. Once you tell people they have to do a thing, of course, you're going to verify that they do that thing. And it's that verification process and these various assaults on our freedoms, including our bodily sovereignty, that are making us more vulnerable to control more than we've ever seen before. And as had been noted, I think in particular by Bobby Kennedy Jr., with technology, the ability to control us, the will has always been there, but the opportunity of the vehicles through tech is like we've never seen. And so to my thinking, and I believe yours, we want to stop this in the earlier stages rather than the later stages. And the stages are getting increasingly late. And, you know, in various cities here, Los Angeles, QR codes and so on, it's a terrifying thing. So the whole range of loss of freedoms and tyrannical oppression through this is truly terrifying. So,
you know, you mentioned, Karen, that the will to engage in tyranny and suppress freedom is always there, and that's certainly true. We've been so blessed in this country, and that's one of the things that I know your American Freedom Association appreciates and does spectacularly important work in lifting up so all of us can recognize it, can learn from your insights. We have a constitution in this country that protects us against tyranny, or has to this point. But what I think brought these crowds together, and I've seen numbers as high as 50,000, and heavens only knows how many millions saw the video elsewhere around the country, or saw the video of the event that took place next day under the sponsorship of marvelous United States Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, where he essentially reprised for 5 hours the medical professionals, some of the best in the country, some of the certainly most courageous in the country, and victims of these vaccines, and celebrities, and authors, and others who have joined this fight for freedom against the tyranny that, and I know you were well versed in this, Karen, and I think our audience is generally because we talk about it a lot, but it can't be said enough that we're on the slippery slope of those who yearn for tyranny, being able to take down our constitutional republic and the freedoms that we enjoy under it through something that looks an awful lot like the Chinese social credit system. And just talk a little bit about that. You mentioned these enforcement techniques, but this is Orwellian on steroids. And how close would you say we are to something like that being insinuated in this country and compulsively applied to the
Yeah, terrifyingly close. And not just because there's the will from the top for your own good, right? It's always for your own good. It was under the Nazis.
And those on top know best what's your own good, right?
Right, right. So I think we're very, very, not only are we close in terms of the will of the powers that be and their brilliant propagandizing, but what chills me even more than that is here in Los Angeles, and I know DC, you can't get your hair cut, you can't go to the gym, you can't go to a restaurant without showing your papers. So that they decided that is bad enough. But when you see people walking up to a restaurant or a salon, grabbing for their iPhones or cell phones to show their papers, that's what I find the most profoundly chilling. People are eager. They're falling all over themselves to show that they are worthy of entrance one way or another, and that you, meaning me, are not. So they are the chosen ones. They can go in. They can do these things. Because of a virus that is 99% survivable, for which there have been treatments, the vaccines don't do anything good.
They do harm.
Something
in fact,
good, but they definitely do harm. And still, people are falling all over themselves to comply. Now, this whole notion of compliance—we've all been saying this: you can't comply yourself into freedom, you can't comply yourself out of tyranny, and yet that's what everyone is doing. So that's for this one now perceived threat. There will be a pivot to green stuff. Yeah. And then social credit scores. Absolutely.
Let me just hone in on one point that's kind of implicit in what you just said, but I think it needs to be specifically addressed. It's not just that people are indulging in sort of virtue signaling or their superiority, for that matter, by both being vaccinated and then having proof of their vaccinations and, encouraging, really, those in power to impose restrictions on all of us. But specifically, what has in the past been described as the other. And the other is now part and parcel of what's being done here to those who've been unvaccinated, chosen to be unvaccinated, those who've sought for religious reasons or others to not be vaccinated, those who've had the disease and therefore have natural immunity that surpasses what you can get, we're told, from these vaccines. Just describe, if you would briefly, Karen, the very ugly history of the other and the mistreatment that it's used to justify.
There's all tyrannical regimes have chosen one way of fostering unity of some kind and empowering their own selves has been this creation of the other. Of course, Jews have historically been the other and cast out, always cast out, always cast out. And obviously, in Hitler's Germany, the Jews were the other. Other groups were also the other, but they were the quintessential. And once you dehumanize a group by considering them the other, not just that they're different, but they're dangerous by virtue of whatever, once you've dehumanized people, what you do is you gather the rest of society as it's not just virtue signaling, it's actual. You are a better, you are actively helping your society. You're not just saying you are, but you are by helping to purge, because you're purging of bad, and so you're elevating the good. It's just classic with othering. And we've been othered. We conservatives have been othered. We MAGA people have been othered. And when the
canceling
virus hit,
is a way of infecting that, isn't it?
And
in a way, this brings us back, and Karen, we're just out of time for today, but it brings us back to where we started. This is something, as you mentioned, that our friend Larry Greenfield devoted considerable effort to warning about in his six-part series, for example, about freedom of speech, because that is where it begins. Oftentimes, you get the Star of David pinned to you after you've already been silenced, after you've already been marginalized, after you've already had your freedom of movement, for example, restricted. And this is one of the things that I think made that event last weekend so important. I should say it was actually 10 days ago now, wasn't it? A little over Sunday before last.
It was Sunday, just a week.
Yeah, it seems like last weekend, but there has been an intervening weekend. But my point is this, Karen, and it was so important to share this experience with you. The people who stood up for freedom at that march to defeat the vaccine mandates aren't the other. They're American. They're patriots. They love freedom, and they're putting their professional futures, in some cases, perhaps even their lives, on the line to defend all of ours in whatever way, not violently, of course, but through the practice of medicine, through public oration, through activism of various kinds. And it's a privilege to have been among them, most especially with you, my dear. I hope we'll have a chance to visit with you again soon. In the meantime, stay well and keep up the great work you do at the American Freedom Association. Next up, we'll speak with another great freedom fighter.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it's always a delight to be able to say we are joined by Congressman, an ambassador, a chairman, and a, well, great friend of the Center for Security Policy and the Cause of Freedom. All of those titles apply to, of course, our colleague, Congressman, former ambassador, former chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, current chairman of the Center for Security Policy's Board of Advisors, Pete Hoekstra. Mr. Wonderful, I think is the short way to do this. It's good to have you with us again, Congressman. Thank you so much.
Frank, it is always good to be with you. You can shorten the introduction so we can get right down
get
to the
right
good
to it.
Stuff.
Good. Well, let's do it. Pete, a number of things are on my mind that I wanted to hit with you. We are, of course, as you are very well aware, being afflicted by a virus that most, I think, serious people now believe is indeed associated with the Chinese Communist Party's biological warfare program. It seems, ironically, at the moment, to be in some form afflicting the Chinese themselves. And in the midst of all this, we are sending scores of our best athletes and training teams and staff and so on into the belly of the beast in Beijing, China, for the Olympic Games, Winter Games coming up next month. How inadvisable is that in your view, and why?
Well, it's totally inadvisable. I mean, you really don't know what's going on in China, because since the beginning of this whole pandemic, the one thing that China has not been, it has not been transparent. It has not been forthcoming with the American people. It has not been forthcoming with the international community about what it knew, when it knew it, And the most effective states are the most effective steps to alleviate it. So why should we send some of our best athletes into, as you describe it, the belly of the beast and expect anything different? It's a dangerous situation, and it's providing recognition and legitimacy to a government that I think you and I both believe within the next 90 to 180 days, there will be those who can make a compelling case that the Chinese unleashed this virus willingly into the global environment.
I thought you were going to say in the next 90 to 180 days, the Chinese will be attacking Taiwan. And
they could be doing that too.
But yeah. The first is bad enough. The second may flow directly from these games. And I just have to believe that everyone, certainly in a position of responsibility, must appreciate that what we are doing by sending our athletes into these games in this moment is emboldening the Chinese Communist Party. And that's the last thing we should be doing, isn't it?
Well, it's the last thing we should be doing. But remember, Frank, the narrative under the last 8 to 12 months of the Trump administration, and now the first 12 months of this Biden administration, at least on the pandemic, the narrative coming from, quote unquote, our intelligence community has been, we don't really know where this virus came from. We don't believe that the government of China released this intentionally. And the only reason they haven't communicated with the world on a more transparent basis, and that they haven't allowed an investigation, is that the world, they're afraid the world won't treat them nicely and won't treat them fairly. Now, this is coming from our intelligence community under both Donald Trump and Joe Biden. So why should the American people be concerned about that? They accept stuff from our intelligence community almost at face value, although there's really no reason for them to do that.
To the contrary, there's a growing reason, and you've been in a position to oversee this for some time. You know probably as well as anybody that the intelligence community writ large has been serially missing the true threats that are emerging to us around the world and mischaracterizing them as a result, perhaps causing, certainly encouraging, poor decisions to be made by policymakers. Which brings me to sort of the next point, Pete. Matters are being made even worse, as we've talked about from time to time in the past with you, by the policy choices and direction that the intelligence community is being given to focus their efforts on internal enemies, so-called insurrectionists, domestic terrorists, and the like, who seem to have a lot in common with Trump voters, conservatives, veterans, gun owners, religious and constitutional, champions, and the like. To what extent is this not simply a question of totally improperly weaponizing our national security agencies against the American people, but worse, compounding the shortcomings of our threat assessments where the real enemies of this country are, here at home, yes, but certainly overseas as well?
Well, I mean, it's very frightening, Frank, exactly what is happening. A real discredit to our law enforcement and policing community domestically, as well as a continued degradation of the intelligence community. Think about it. Our law enforcement officials on the border, right? They get into a shouting match with their DC leadership. Why? Because they see each and every day, they see thousands of people coming across the border illegally. They're law enforcement officers, and they don't do a thing about it. I don't know if you just saw what came out, I think, in the last 24 hours. The Department of Justice has decided that it is not going to defend the U.S. Marshal who protected the U.S. federal courthouse in Portland against the attacks by Antifa. 12, 18 months ago. And it's like, wait a minute, I'm a U.S. Marshal, I'm protecting U.S. federal property, and the Department of Justice says it's not in our best interest to provide you with legal protection. And then you've got these poor folks at TSA who are not, they're not law enforcement officials, but they are security officials. They are employed by the federal government, and they're required to accept. Think about this. As you get on the plane and you put on your mask to protect yourself from the person sitting next to you, you know that you have the possibility that the person sitting next to you got onto the plane and the piece of identification that they used to get through TSA was an arrest warrant. It's like you can't make this stuff up.
You can't make it up. And then, that's exactly right.
And then, you know, as they keep talking about domestic terrorists and that the intelligence community needs to focus on that, it's like, no, excuse me, Russia is, I don't know, they may be exaggerating this claim, but, you know, Russia does have 100,000 plus troops on the border with Ukraine. Iran is sowing instability through the Houthis throughout the Middle East. They're attacking an ally, the United Arab Emirates. And then you got China playing its games. And then, oh, get back to Russia. They just sent troops into Kazakhstan to put down unrest against that regime. So it's like, excuse me, the intelligence community has enough work out there to do. There's enough enemies out there without saying, oh, the scariest thing in America today are domestic terrorists. No, excuse me, there are plenty of threats outside that the intelligence community is, you know, needs to be focused on to keep us safe.
Look, I'm willing to stipulate that there are domestic terrorists in our country. I think you've got, some percentage of 100,000 Afghans who've just been imported into this country without vetting. I'm sure there are some domestic terrorists now as a result of that. There are other Islamists in our country. We saw one, you know, taking people hostage in Colleyville, Texas recently. And why? Because he was trying to free a terrorist who sought to use weapons of mass destruction to kill large numbers of us. And you've got a bunch of other Sharia supremacists, Muslim Brotherhood organizations and the like, who are still championing her release from jail. And then, of course, you've got the Black Lives Matter and the Antifa characters who, as you say, you know, were torching a federal courthouse among an awful lot of other places and cities. So they're there. It's just those aren't seemingly the people that this administration is focused on fingering or trying to get the U.S. intelligence and other security agencies to address. Hey, Pete, you were, among other things, as I mentioned, and we're talking with Congressman Pete Hoekstra, who went on from Capitol Hill to become our ambassador to the Netherlands. And I wanted to ask you about those Russian troops across the border from Ukraine and your sense of how this is actually playing out. Is Vladimir Putin successfully fracturing NATO without actually sending troops in? Is he not only getting our attention, in other words, but is he subverting the NATO alliance, as you see it from your vantage point previously in the Netherlands?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have, the message coming from the Biden administration is, hey, we're all on the same page. NATO is united. And it's kind of like, I don't think so. The Germans and the Dutch built and funded the pipeline, the Nord Stream 2. The Germans are, you know, we're saying, hey, that pipeline's going to be shut down if Russia attacks. The Germans aren't that much in favor of it. You've got our friend Macron again in France. While I was the ambassador in the Netherlands, he was talking about the need for NATO to, or excuse me, yeah, for the EU to establish its own army. And it's kind of like, hey, good luck, Mr. President. You guys aren't even willing to pay for NATO and you think you're going to stand up your own army. But, you know, that was his vision for where they should go. And then more recently now with Ukraine, Macron is saying maybe the EU should negotiate separately from the United States with Russia. That doesn't sound to me like a coalition that is all on the same page. It sounds like a coalition that doesn't necessarily trust each other and has very, very different views towards Russia. And so, yeah, Putin is sitting there and he's driving wedges between, even though Joe Biden was welcomed back into the club, Putin is driving wedges between the U.S., Germany, and France. And then you go along with it to actually, you know, kind of strengthen this relationship. Many countries in the EU right now don't even have an American ambassador. It hasn't been a priority for Putin to put diplomats into Biden to put diplomats into key allies in Europe. It's totally dysfunctional.
The question is, sir,
is taking advantage of it.
You've seen a lot of administrations over the years, Pete, Republican and Democratic. You've served with great distinction in the United States Congress under presidents of both parties. I'm persuaded, and I'd just be interested in your closing thoughts on this quickly, if you could, whether this is not simple dysfunctionality or even incompetence, as some have suggested, but a deliberate wrecking operation by an administration that seems intent on strengthening our enemies, as we've talked about, emboldening them, and weakening the forces of good, the United States and its, what's left of the free world allies. What are your thoughts?
Well, this is for our next discussion. They believe it strengthens the institutions that they believe in. They don't believe in nationalism. They don't believe in a strong America. They never believed in America first. These are globalists, okay? The leaders that we have in charge here in the U.S., along with the group that's in charge in Europe, they are globalists. They believe in global institutions that will make the world a better place. I'm not willing, I want an American president negotiating on America's best interest, not ceding that to some bureaucrats and some godforsaken corner of the world, wherever the globalists want to establish their capital, and telling us what's good for America, and bringing harmony, because you got a problem.
Very, very
China,
important insight.
Yep. Iran and Russia don't agree with this.
Right. And they agree with each other, and they are collaborating assuredly to our detriment. Congressman, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I appreciate so much your visiting with us, and we will return to this topic, as you say, in the very near future with your help. I thank you for your time. I thank you all for your time, in fact, and hope that you'll give us a little bit more of it tomorrow. Same time, same station, as a matter of fact. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.